This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The state agricultural economy is entering its fourth straight down year, and farmers are cutting.
85% of them plan to delay equipment purchases. Over a third of them plan to try to reduce interest payments or their farm debt.
Illinois Farm Bureau economist Mike Doherty says there's huge support for NAFTA among Illinois farmers, in spite of the Trump administration position on the issue. McLean County GOP Chair Chuck Erickson talks with Ryan Denham about candidate filings, not only in his own party, but from white male libertarians and female Democrats. State Senator Jason Berrickman chats about the proposal to legalize marijuana, and Mayor Coos talks property taxes. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's December 5th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Taxes will go up in the town of Normal. Officials say it's to fund police and fire pensions. The increase generated more than the usual number of public comments during a public hearing. In the studio to talk about the tax increases, the political ramifications, and the community investment plan is Mayor Chris Coos. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Mayor Coos, welcome.
Good afternoon.
This increase is to fund pensions. It's also closely tied to the projected 2019 budget. Is there not room in the budget, as some during public comment asked, to cut or reduce spending in some areas to find the money or some of the money to fund pensions?
Well, in the sense, yes, it is there if you're willing to do deeper cuts. What services would you like to eliminate? Do we go to private garbage pickup? Do we reduce our police force? Do we reduce our fire department? And then our insurance, ISO insurance rating goes down and you end up paying more for your homeowner's insurance. It's not a simple solution. And we have always identified property tax as the most reliable and steady source of income to fund these pensions.
Let's talk about spending. That's another area that those speaking during public comment talked about. And let's talk about what that money was spent on. Here's what you had to say last night about spending.
And people brought up the point of spending, the fact that we spent money. But nobody talks about what that money was spent for and what kind of long-term investment it was in our community. The $90 million that you hear about our bond rating, nobody talks that it generated up to almost $200 million of private investment in our community. Nobody talks about the fact that we incented a property that was paying about $30,000 a year in property tax and sales taxes and is being replaced by a property that is generating somewhere in the neighborhood of $450,000 a year.
That's Mayor Coos from last night's council meeting. Mayor Coos, you summed up by saying people focus on spending, but they don't focus on the long-term gain that came with the spending. You cited a couple of examples there. Can you go into detail about one of those examples?
Sure. We had a property, I think most people identified it as a Portillo's property, where we were asked to make an investment for the developer to make it work. And our approach on that, while it took a lot of heat, was that it, over the 20 or 30 year life of that property, that is going to generate significant revenue for the town, you know. And to get into a broad brush on this, Mike, a lot of these things are the result of multiple things that are happening in our city. Our sales tax is going down, state income tax receipts are going down. Property values are staying pretty steady. Our EEVA isn't increasing that much.
You also lost the Metrozone revenue.
There's
a state, I think you called it a state grab of sales tax dollars back.
Correct. So you have all these issues that are pushing on government. And in terms of cutting spending, you're going to see that in our next round of budget discussions when we have our budget hearings and that. There will be cuts. There's no question of that. But you know, we have to constantly do a balancing act on providing high-quality services to our citizens, which they demand, but they don't come without a cost.
You also said no one is talking about this. That includes the town. I don't recall seeing any Facebook posts or news releases regularly saying some of the things you pointed out last night. Should the town be doing a better job of communicating the information you think is so important in terms of how the town spends its money and what you would call investments?
Yes, I would say that that's something that we need to be doing a better job of. It was a point of discussion in our recent strategic plan, and you will be seeing some examples of that. I think the first you're going to see is on the website. It's called Myth and Fact. And we're going to take some of these issues that are going around, that are commonly held beliefs, and put the flesh in the background of it so people really understand what's going on.
And do you expect to use your bully pulpit more? I mean, you spoke last night from the council chambers.
I you know, it's not my style to do that, but I probably should do more of that. You know, I listen to a lot of people, and I preface my comments with, if I were getting the information that I get through local media, not to bash local media, but it's not in depth. It's not the kind of information and the depth of information and the time that the council spends with these issues. If I were in that situation, I'd probably be angry too. I understand the people's frustration.
And in defense of the media, you can only give so much time and
exactly.
So much detail to these issues because people's eyes start glazing over if we provide spreadsheet after spreadsheet.
No, I completely agree with that.
How much are we talking about? What's the impact on the owner of an average-priced home with these property tax increases?
$165 home, I think the number is about $50, $54, somewhere in that neighborhood.
You and City Manager Mark Peterson and past councils have the town on a trajectory of public investment in Uptown and elsewhere that you think is productive. This trajectory and legacy, for that matter, could be changed with a new council or mayor. Do you think during the public hearing on property tax increases that you're hearing from some future candidates?
Well, that's a hard one to call. You know, obviously we had two prior candidates that spoke. Some of the other people, no, I don't think so. Some people, maybe. It's certainly, you know, our democratic process that if people feel things aren't going the right way and they want to invest the time to run for office and serve, so be it.
Does that next election, though, do anything to your resolve to continue to push out information about the town's public investments and financial position?
Ask me that in what would that be? May of 2019.
Okay. I will make a note. That's Mayor Coos. He's on Sound Ideas about every other week following Monday evening council meetings. Let's talk about the Community Investment Program, or CIP, for 2018 through 2023. Sewer services are a core service for the town, and there's some priority funding more than last year. What's driving that?
A sewer study that we did and an increase in sewer fees. Sewer fund, water fund, or what they call enterprise funds, and we charge people at a break even on the costs of those services. And, you know, one has to just look around at communities that don't do an intensive reinvestment in their infrastructure. The costs skyrocket. You know, it's pay me now or pay me later. And when you pay me later, it's usually a lot more money.
And it's hard to catch up.
Yes.
What about priorities for you in the CIP? What jumps out at you as important in all of these priorities?
Well, I don't think there's anything that really jumps out at me. I mean, I think they're all very important priorities. You know, when you look at infrastructure, it's not exciting stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's hugely important to the function of a community.
Citizens use it every day.
Exactly.
The town is planning to replace its public library at some point. Am I ever looking this in the CIP? Was that in the CIP?
I don't think that was in the CIP at this point. No.
And why not?
We're not there yet.
So not even 6 years out.
Right. We need to, you know, we've got fundraising issues. The library board is doing a imaging study, if you will, what a future library might look like. There are a lot of questions to be answered before we start putting numbers in the budget.
Coming full circle, there's a lot of street resurfacing, bridge improvements in the CIP. One of those providing comment at the public hearing on the property tax increase made a point of saying that more was spent on cultural and recreational spending than on streets. Are you satisfied with the condition of town streets spending in the CIP for resurfacing and improvements? And what about the comparison between the two funds?
Well, you know, that to me, that wasn't a valid comparison. So you're taking the whole Parks and Rec budget and our cultural arts budget and comparing that to one item of our public works budget. It's not a valid comparison.
And what about the condition of Bloomington or of Town of Normal Streets? Are you satisfied with that?
Are you satisfied
with how you're addressing those?
We are. You know, we'd like to do a little bit more, but we have to work with the dollars that we have. We did an independent study of our concrete streets just a couple of years ago because we thought, you know, they're not in very good shape. And the independent firm that did it came back and said, well, they're better than you think they are. And here are areas where you need work. But some of these areas we're concerned about were really in pretty good shape.
And it's also led to some resurfacing of those cement streets.
Well, redoing the joints.
And Blair Drive is one that comes to mind that was resurfaced last year. Okay, Mayor Kuss, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Chris Kuss and Mayor Terry Renner join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
For GLT comes from Country Financial, where taking small steps now can help you achieve a bright financial future. Additional support comes from the friends of GLT. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The issue of legalizing recreational use of marijuana is rising in profile this year. There are two bills in the General Assembly. Several Democratic candidates for governor have embraced the proposal, saying it would bring badly needed revenue to the state and reduce black market and gang control of an existing industry. Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, though, bluntly opposed the idea last week in a television interview in Marion. Now, GOP State Senator Jason Berrickman of Bloomington Normal says he's breaking with the governor on legalized marijuana. In this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Berrickman says he believes the idea is coming no matter what.
It's very clear that Illinois is moving down a path where the legalization of cannabis is likely to occur sooner than later. I think lawmakers have all taken some of the, you know, taken the opportunity to learn about this issue, to understand the complexities of it. And, you know, as we embark towards 2018, you know, I think it's important for us to firm up where we stand on this issue. I'm willing to support the legalization of cannabis for adult use, provided that appropriate safeguards are in place. And I think that as the public, you know, wrestles with this issue, it's important that we have an actual public dialogue on what those appropriate safeguards are, what they look like, what the expectations of the public may be.
Well, let's talk about some of the facets of the public discourse. Some people view it as a moral issue. Do you?
I don't believe it's a moral issue. I think it's a controversial issue, you know, much like alcohol and tobacco and other items that are in the public sphere but are regulated. This is one of those. The question is, how do you regulate it appropriately? The answer as of today is you make it completely illegal, but clearly that policy position hasn't been working. People are using marijuana. It's not a deterrent to its use. People are using marijuana. There's an incredible black market that's been formed as a result of marijuana use and trade. I think there's an opportunity here for the government to tax and regulate and to stop enabling, you know, whether it's the drug cartels or others who today are receiving significant windfalls because of the fact that the government's made this illegal.
Within the context of public health issues, then, there are varying views all the way from U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who views it as a serious addiction problem, in the nation to those in Colorado or what have you who see very little to distinguish it from alcohol, just something that needs to be handled carefully as adults handle substances carefully. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Well, I think there's a balance here, and the balance comes through what those regulations look like. I think for the government to lump marijuana use with some of the other drugs that are causing real societal issues, we've had a lot of attention placed recently on the opioid epidemic that's really plagued our country. As we look to balance our state and federal budgets, I think we have to prioritize our spending and we have to prioritize dollars to the programs that work. If you look, today, the governments treat marijuana like it treats opioids, but they're very different drugs. They're very different effects, addiction issues. And so I think we need a reprioritization here. There's concerns raised by some that, if Illinois were to go down the legalization path, that we may suddenly become the wild, wild west. And I think when I say that there's a balance here that's necessary, it's that balance between the law that exists today and the wild west. And I think there's areas that we can look at that already exist in the law today that we can emulate for cannabis use. You look at the laws, public health laws. You look at the laws that regulate people who are driving while using alcohol. You look at the public health laws that regulate tobacco. These are areas where we can look to as we would legalize cannabis. The same goes for our youth. There's a longstanding public policy that says that while people are free to make choices, that people who are not yet mature enough to make choices for themselves get guidance, regulations. And so that exists in alcohol and tobacco. I think the same model, how we treat juveniles with cannabis use, again, we can look to those existing laws as a basis for how we might legalize cannabis.
Opponents of that notion prophesy huge increases in youth rates of marijuana use. Colorado, there's some evidence that that has not been the case. Where is the data on that beyond just Colorado? What have you looked at?
Well, I've studied this, I've seen a lot of studies published by kind of both sides of this issue. Unfortunately, both sides have data that backs up their claims. We got to wade through that and, make policy choices here that will work for Illinoisans. I don't anticipate that you're going to see significant changes in use as a result of legalization. I think what you'll see is some changed behaviors. That's what happens when a government regulates something. It influences behaviors. I think that we'll see tax revenue, some say significant tax revenue generated from this. And again, for me, I come to this, I come to this issue as a fiscal conservative. Someone who believes that we need to reprioritize our spending on that issue. It's a no-brainer here that we have other important priorities, opioid use again being one of those, and our attempts to combat its use. I come as a fiscal conservative who recognizes that we need to broaden our tax base. This is an issue, the broadened tax base has been one that we've talked about through our budget stalemate of the last 3 years. Clearly, this is an opportunity to broaden the tax base and hold, if not reduce, some of the individual income tax rates that today we're struggling with. I think this is an opportunity to move on some of those items.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with State Senator Jason Berrickman about the potential for legalized use of marijuana. You're a relatively early announcement among Republicans for this particular policy choice. Why is it important for you to get out early on this?
I'm concerned that if we don't have a bipartisan effort here to legalize, then we'll be left with what one party comes up with for a solution. I think that the best public policies come from bipartisan input. There's a give and a take that is part and parcel to the bipartisan process. And on this issue, we desperately need the bipartisan input. We need fiscal conservatives. We need people who have a mindset that says that there's a law enforcement and prosecutorial system that needs to have some reasonable input to this debate. Whether or not some of those ideas would exist if this issue only proceeded with Democrat input, I think is, you know, one never knows. But the point is that the best laws that are put into place, the laws that are supported most widely by the public, are those laws that have broad-based bipartisan support. So as Republicans, I think we need to sit at this negotiating table. I think we need to demonstrate our willingness to be open-minded on this issue. And I've been very clear that I intend to support this so long as we have those appropriate safeguards in place. What we need to do is spend the coming weeks and months hashing out what those appropriate safeguards look like and making sure that the end product is one that a majority of the people of the state would support.
Governor Rauner referred to legalized marijuana in Western states as a massive social experiment. You cited a number of studies on both sides of the issue. Where are reliable studies that you can hang your hat on to decide? Let's get into the nitty-gritty of policy.
Yeah, I think the most accurate studies come from the professionals in the field who don't have a horse in the race. I look to our, locally, we have some great providers who are dealing with substance abuse and mental health issues. I look to the mental health and the substance abuse community at large as providing us tangible evidence of what they're seeing. You know, their data is more clinically drawn. It's drawn from experts in the field who, again, they may have their personal political feelings about one issue or another, but they're drawing evidence from what they see. In our communities, we have people struggling with substance abuse, but by and large, that substance abuse is things like cocaine and crack and heroin, opioid use, which has, again, garnered a lot of local attention. So I think we need to go to those professionals for their input. I think similarly, you know, one of the very good things that exists in the regulation of alcohol is the bright line standards that have been driven for alcohol use when driving. As a public, we have an expectation that people aren't going to be on a roads driving drunk. I think the public has the same expectation of marijuana use. And so we need to formulate laws that allow for a more bright line standard here. Input again from the people in the field, whether it be law enforcement, who's going to be tasked with making on-site determinations, to prosecutors who are going to be tasked with enforcing the law. We need that input to this debate, again, to make sure we come up with a product that's a law that's sound and reasoned and has input from all those, you know, experts.
You've mentioned the opioid crisis several times. Do you believe that any tax revenue or a substantial portion of tax revenue from legalized marijuana should be devoted to that particular purpose, opioid addiction treatment, or in that realm?
You know, I'm open to it. I think there's clearly going to be a debate over the money. And people want to rush to judgment on, well, what happens if we legalize? What's the pool of money look like and how do we spend it? I think the spending side of this requires bipartisan input. My priorities, which may or may not reflect the final product, but my priorities would be that we look to our backlog, our debt that's obviously needing attention. We look to ways to relieving the tax burden placed on the people of Illinois, whether that means lower income tax rates, property tax relief, or what have you, and that we look to the needs of our local communities around the state. The substance abuse, the mental health providers of our state have been crying for relief. I think this gives us an opportunity for that, the opioid epidemic kind of being a subset of that. But think again, in Bloomington Normal, we hear from our hospitals that their emergency departments are becoming the stay house of certain individuals who have mental health issues and have no place to go. I think that is an epidemic that needs attention. Same issue exists in our jail. Our jail is now housing a lot of mentally ill individuals. we need a solution that works for our local communities on these mental health and substance abuse issues. And I think if we legalize cannabis, we can use some of those dollars to help some of our local communities with those efforts.
Are you going to get substantial pushback from your party on this? The governor is the head of the party. He's the biggest Republican in the state.
Well, you know, I read what he said about legalization, and he said he wanted more studies. I think that's a rally cry for the advocates here to produce some of their work and get it in front of him. I think he needs to hear from Republicans around the state. Clearly, in the Republican Party, this is one of those issues where there's widespread opinion. Some of our more mature voters may have very different views than a young Republican voter on this. Some of your libertarian-minded Republicans may have different views than a social conservative. But when you break it all down, I think what Governor Rauner needs to hear is the fiscal arguments that support this policy. You know, he's governor today. I know he's up for re-election, and if he's governor for the next 4 years, the one thing that's certain in the state is that our financial problems aren't going away overnight. We're going to need to be creative in how we wrestle with those issues. And I think that rather than flippantly dismissing this idea, the governor ought to study it further, hear from Republicans around the state and others, and, you know, reevaluate the position that he's taken on this issue.
How much money could it generate in tax revenue? The Democratic candidates for governor have trotted out those who support the proposal have trotted out estimates ranging from $300 million to $700 million per year. Well, do you have a sense of that?
I don't have a sense. I think the number's significant, but look, you know, we're talking about millions of dollars. It's all significant to any of us as an individual. I think we need to have a reasoned debate, a discussion. That's part of the reason I want to sit at that negotiating table, is to make sure that we have a sound tax policy on the implementation of this. A sound tax policy is going to generate significant revenues, but we also have to be cautious that we don't overplay that hand. You know, there are concerns that we ought to have that if you overtax, what you may do is instill, even in a legalized environment, you may instill the idea that the black market can deliver this at a more cost-efficient manner than in the regulated market. So there's a balance there that I think we can hit, and once we hit that, we'll look and see what those revenues look like.
Is Colorado a guide there where prices have fallen 67%?
I don't think Colorado's a guide as much as it's one of many resources that we'll look at. I think there's a lot to be learned from Colorado, and not necessarily in the right way. You know, Colorado came out early. They came out with a legalization system that I think had some unintended consequences, and so we can learn from that and put in place a more reasoned regulatory scheme, a reasoned tax scheme, based on what we learned from their instance.
What do you think Illinois should not repeat from Colorado?
When I talk about those, you know, regulations, I think what we're best done, what we can do best in Illinois, is to look to Illinois laws that exist today in our public health system, our regulation of alcohol and tobacco, and within our juvenile system. For me, those existing laws are the guidebook for what we may do for cannabis use. Rather than saying, let's take the law that Colorado or some, you know, California is on the brink of adoption, rather than looking at, so is Michigan, by the way, I think, rather than looking at these other states as the starting point, I think we look to ourselves as the starting point. We look to what the other states have done well and look to adopt from there.
Some advocates have said this year is too soon for a bill to be ready to pass. GOP State Senator Jason Berrickman says he's not sure exactly when a bill would pass. He did say he would be surprised if it were later than 2019. Berrickman spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker on Sound Ideas. Ahead during Sound Ideas, the Illinois Farm Bureau chief economist paints a picture of the agricultural economy in Illinois after three down years. That interview is ahead. During Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. McLean County voters learned yesterday they have more choices on their 2018 ballots, with incumbents facing several challenges from a new cadre of Democratic women candidates and an energized Libertarian Party. Republicans are being challenged on many fronts. And longtime state lawmakers like Dan Brady and Keith Summer are facing their first contested elections in years. GLT's Ryan Denham talks to McLean County Republican Party Chair Chuck Erickson about what his incumbents must do to hold their seats in 2018.
Well, I've been telling Republicans all along that the Democrats are energized and they're focused, and they believe that this cycle is going to be advantageous to them. So I've been warning them about the possibility that the day in McLean County where you can win just as a Republican behind your name, it's over. Now, all things being equal, I'd rather run as a Republican, but if you don't go out and do the stuff that it takes to win a campaign, you will be beat by one of those Democrat candidates. It will happen.
As you give that warning to Republicans in our county, what do you hope that warning translates into? What kind of action are you hoping to see?
Well, you hope the candidate isn't a lazy one. I mean, that's what you hope for. I mean, that the candidate will go out there and do the footwork that it requires to win. I mean, there's two types of candidates. There's the candidate that's infatuated with his name being on a board and his name being in the paper, but doesn't really want to campaign. And there's the other type of candidate that wants to do what it takes to campaign. And, you know, those are the type of candidates you want.
Now, have you guys done anything specifically within the party to recruit candidates to perhaps offset some of the energy that you're seeing on the other side?
Well, I'm trying to make sure I get that through our volunteer ranks and our precinct committeeman ranks. And every candidate I basically have told, I mean, this really was not a surprise to me. I told every Republican incumbent that you're likely to have a challenger, including myself. I said, you just have to get your mindset ready for that. It's going to happen. This is the cycle it's going to happen in. And if you're not ready for it, you're going to get mowed over by it. So, I mean, I think they're prepared. I hope they are.
That said, were there any surprises that you saw in the filings as they shook out as of yesterday afternoon?
Yeah, I was a little surprised to see that they challenged Paul Segoviano, the Democrats did, and then in our...
And this is Shana Wachinski, a Democrat who's challenging
Paul. Yes,
I
was surprised to see that. That shocked me a little bit. And I was surprised to see that Jim Soldner got a primary, because I did not know anything about that.
That's Jay Snyder.
Yeah.
And that's around rural McLean County.
Yes. Those were the surprises. We were a little surprised that the Libertarians came on so strong, but I was not surprised with what the Democrats did. I expected that.
What's your take on that increased visibility of the McLean County Libertarian Party? One of the reasons they're able to do that is they have some easier ballot access issues now that their presidential candidate did half decent in 2016. But what's your take on the push they're making? They've got eight candidates who filed this time around?
Well, you know, I think it's a very anti-incumbent mood. I just think they feel that this is their opportunity now that they were able to get themselves on the ballot. I think they got over 5%, which made them a valid party in McLean County, so they could be treated like the other parties. And thus, they feel they have an opportunity.
You've acknowledged a bit of an anti-incumbent mood, but do you see the increased visibility of Libertarians as a potential threat to Republican candidates, too?
Well, I would think that the Libertarians would draw votes from Republicans. That's what I would think. But it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know their strength. You know, there are people, Libertarians, in my view, tend to be conservative, I guess, for lack of a better way to say it, on economic issues, and very socially liberal on the social issues. And that could pull a Democrat, too. Who knows? But, I mean, in the county board races, the social issues don't matter. I mean, it's not really a social issue race. It's more of a fiscal issue race. And so I think that could hurt Republicans potentially. But on the other hand, I think people should remember that, in my view, they're a county board, and this will get me in trouble with the town and the city, but I think the county board is the best-run government in McLean County. And I think we're very fiscally conservative, and that's because we have Republicans that are the majority on the county board.
So a lot of races potentially set up for November. So what are going to be the most important races for the McLean County Republican Party?
We will probably emphasize trying to at least maintain our 15-5 majority on the county board. I mean, I think that's a priority that we should be focused on, and I think we should also be focused on the governor's race. I think it's very important that, especially with, I think the redistricting comes up in 2020 and 2022, and we need a Republican in the governor's mansion, no matter how you feel about a particular candidate, at some point. You know, the rule is you vote your conscience in the primary and you vote your party in the general. So, I mean, Republicans had better come out and vote, because if they don't come out and vote, the Democrats are coming out to vote. And I think that's what we're seeing. And so if they don't come out and vote and they sit it out, we will feel the pain of that, I guess.
We have a couple of longtime state representatives, Dan Brady and Keith Sommer, who both have primary and or general election challengers for the first time in a while. Do you see either Dan Brady or Keith Sommer as potentially vulnerable in 2018, given all that you've talked to me about already?
I don't know. I mean, like I said, it is a little bit of an anti-incumbent mood, I think. But it's just hard for me to imagine, and I like David Paul Blumenschein. I think he's a great guy, but it's hard for me to imagine Dan Brady, with as hard as he works, being beat by anybody ever. I mean, I just don't see it, but... we'll see.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Chuck Erickson, the chairman of the McLean County Republican Party and a member of the McLean County Board. As a county board member yourself, Chuck, how unusual is it to see 9 of these 10 contested races? I'm used to seeing 1 or 2 contested races per cycle myself. I haven't lived here that long, but that's kind of what I'm used to seeing. And now we've got 9 of 10 of them are contested.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if they all get contested in the end, okay? That we have a contested race in every race, because you have to remember that the parties can still slate a candidate through June 4th. Okay, so the parties could slate anybody against any of the uncontested races and put somebody in the general election. So it wouldn't surprise me if they all end up being contested, because it's just that type of election cycle. It just is. Yes, it's surprising to me. You don't typically see that. This is not the norm. It's the exception. But, you know, it's good for democracy. I mean, people are getting a choice, and that's what people complain about when there aren't challengers, is that, well, I didn't really have a choice. Well, I don't think that complaint can be valid this cycle.
Speaking of choices, Jim Soldner, a Republican from Ellsworth, who is also the county board's vice chairman, he now has both a primary challenger, Jay Snyder, and a Democratic and Libertarian challenger, should he make it to the general election. I guess, what is going on there? Why is he drawing so much attention out there?
I have no idea. I have no idea what Jim did that has somebody out there not happy with him. Now, I'm sure that's going to get me some criticism from my right, but, you know, I think Jim's been a fairly conservative member on the county board, you know, and I think he's been a good county board member. But apparently, I'm not sure where Jay Snyder is coming from. I do understand in the precinct race, I do understand where Diane Benjamin comes from. But, you know, I think that Jim's fine. I don't know. Obviously, on the county board, we don't always agree on every issue, but we agree more often than we disagree.
So you've got a lot of local candidates, but you've also have an unpopular Republican governor and an unpopular Republican president at this point. So what is the right amount of distance to put between your priorities here in McLean County and Governor Rauner and President Trump?
That's a tough question. I think that there are some things that I've not agreed with the governor on. I didn't agree with the abortion veto. No, the abortion signing, he didn't veto it. But on the other hand, I tend to be very pragmatic, and I think that you're certainly free to vote your conscience in a primary. I wouldn't discourage anybody from doing so. But when it comes to the general election, you can't sit it out. You've got to go vote for your party. And I think that's what you have to do. In regards to Trump, I mean, I think all Republicans, I think there was a poll that said a lot of Republicans were very upset with the way he tweets all the time, okay? And they're like, some of these tweets don't have anything to do with being president, okay? And I think that's true. And I think most Republicans would distance themselves from some of the tweets and some of the things that he says. But then they would focus back on his job performance. And if you look at his job performance, we do have high economic growth. And we do have, it looks like it's going to be sustained. And I think we have a good tax bill coming out, which I think will spur more economic growth. I think a lot of Republicans need to remember that the Democrats and everybody considered Ronald Reagan dead in 1982. They thought he was going to be a one-termer. Now, I don't know what's going to happen to Trump, but we'll see. But I think it's a little too early to be writing the obituary for Governor Rauner and President Trump. I would be very cautious about that if I were on the other side, because Governor Rauner is a good campaigner. I think he does relate to the common, relates to everybody very well. And I think most people understand his message that if you don't reform the way Illinois does things, then it's kind of like the definition of insanity. We're doing the same thing over and over again, and people are leaving the state, and businesses are fleeing the state, and something has to change. And I think that he's pushing for that, but he has so, they're in such a minority down in Springfield that it's hard to do a whole lot. And so, as I try to explain to people, the issue here is not that you're going to win it in one cycle. You're going to have to chip away cycle after cycle to get it back, and it probably can't be done in one gubernatorial cycle. It's probably going to take a second one.
Do you worry that some of the things that are happening nationally to the Republican Party brand might hurt you here? And this isn't a super conservative place anymore, as you said, changing demographics kind of being what they are. How do you kind of balance that?
It could. I mean, it could, but I still think people like their government to be limited. I still think people like their government to be efficient. I still think people like their government to tax them at a low rate to the extent that it's possible. The Republican Party is not no government. We're not libertarians. We are limited government, okay? And I think sometimes people forget that. We firmly believe that there has to be a government. We just think that it should be limited in scope and objectives. And I think most people still want it that way. I still think most people believe in personal responsibility and accountability. And I think most people understand that if you tax someone to death, they're going to leave. They're going to go to a state where they're taxed less. And I think most people understand that. And I think the Republican brand is still strong. We shall see what happens in 2018. But I'm not so certain that some of the anger that you're seeing is necessarily anti-Republican as it is anti-incumbent. I just think there's a lot of anti-incumbent feelings right now. It's just, we don't care what party you are part of, you're part of the problem. I mean, you've been there for X amount of years, it's time to go. And I think there's a lot of feeling like that right now.
That's Chuck Erickson, chairman of the McLean County Republican Party and a member of the McLean County Board. I'm Ryan Denham.
This conversation continues tomorrow with perspective from the McLean County Democratic Party. Treasurer John Whalen talks with Ryan Denham about his energized party's chances next year. The primary election is March 20th, 2018. The general election is November 6th. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT, and we want to know what you think of this program. Share your opinion. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. The 1998 McNeil murder case starts with a 911 call reporting the lifeless body of 3-year-old Bloomington resident Christina. Eventually, her father, Barton McNeil, is charged and convicted.
All I sought was justice for my child.
The podcast Suspect Convictions investigates, is Barton McNeil innocent as he claims?
The alternate theory defies the rules of science.
Hear the podcast Suspect Convictions, Fridays at noon and 6 during Sound Ideas. More at WGLT.org/suspectconvictions.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois is now in year four of fairly low farm income, and no turnaround is in sight, according to Farm Bureau Chief Economist Mike Dougherty. In this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlinker, Dougherty says this is mainly due to low prices tied to increases in supply from competitors in Argentina and Brazil. Dougherty says this year represents a slight decrease from last year in Illinois.
Even though we are still selling our exports overseas, and we're capturing those sales, we have a declining share compared to South America. So it makes it more difficult for our farmers, and it backs up our supply of corn and soybeans, that we end up with lower domestic prices.
Since the Trump election and the president's emphasis on manufacturing protection, are we seeing an impact on the farm economy from larger U.S. economic policy?
No, not really. Nothing has happened there in terms of this administration changing anything. It's still, you know, just has to do with gold more than anything else, global supply and demand.
Is there a perception issue, though, with foreign ag customers saying, I don't know what the U.S. will do about NAFTA, or what is the president going to do now that TPP is dead? So I will look to other suppliers for additional product.
They haven't made our main buyers, as you know, or for soybean side is China and Southeast Asia. And on the corn side, and especially if you include our meat products, then you're looking at Mexico and Canada. Particularly Mexico is a very strong market for us, and then followed by both Japan and South Korea there. And they haven't changed their purchases from us. In fact, in 2017, both corn was down only slightly in the middle of the year. It ended up pretty high, and our dried distiller grains, which is a corn-like product that comes out of our ethanol plants, actually increased in sales to Mexico. So what we do know, though, is from the people we work with in Mexico, is they're nervous about the future and with the U.S. pull out of NAFTA. And if that were to happen, then those buyers could see an increase in the price of corn that they normally buy from us. So, yes, they are talking more to other suppliers than they would have in the past. Part of that, though, is because, as I said, both Argentina and Brazil have simply increased their exports anyway. Argentina elected a new president almost 2 years ago. I think it was actually just about 2 years ago, and eliminated an export tax on corn and allowed their currency to float, which caused the value of their currency to decline, made them much more competitive in the corn market. And over in Brazil and further north in Brazil, their producers expanded their what they call their double cropping or second crop of corn after soybeans. So there's been, you know, increased availability from both Argentina and Brazil, regardless of what the U.S. was going to do. It's just that, you know, with the talk of withdrawing from NAFTA, yeah, of course, our buyers, certainly Mexico, are you know, talking to the people who now are knocking on their door and saying, we've got more corn than we had last year.
What are farmers doing in Illinois as a result of three going on 4 years of low prices?
Right. So the farmers are changing what they can change, which is a lot of it involves cost cutting. So we had a survey we did of our farmers here who are attending the Illinois Farm Bureau annual meeting in Chicago yesterday and today. And that survey results showed that 85% of them are delaying their plan to delay equipment purchases. So in other words, get by with the equipment you have. Don't invest more. Over a third of them said that they plan to try to reduce their interest payments or their farm debt. And that fits in, if you saw the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank survey that was done in mid-September, and the results, they reported those in November. They had the same results in that district, which covers northern Illinois, which is that an increase in the restructuring and delaying of loan repayments. And they're according to the survey results here in Chicago with our membership, said that they would try, a third said they would try to delay or cut back on fertilizer or chemical purchases, and one-fourth said they would try to reduce their hired labor costs, maybe get by without hiring an extra person during the spring planting and fall harvest seasons.
Agriculture, of course, is huge in Illinois and huge in McLean County, but the overall economy is clipping along at about 3% growth. How much of the entire economy is ag?
It's substantial, and I think what people need to realize is that especially when you're looking downstate Illinois and you look at counties that are almost entirely ag, you look, think of counties like Livingston and ones, you know, outside of McLean County where you don't have a strong non-agricultural base, those counties become very, very dependent on agriculture. Look at states that do not have Chicago that are very ag-dependent, like Iowa. And we're downstate Illinois, ag economy is very similar to Iowa. Bloomington, Peoria, you could transfer to Waterloo and Des Moines, right? And when you look at that, that gives kind of a clear picture because you don't have Chicago in the numbers, in the mix. And you look at those states during those four boom years of, 2009 through 2013, and they were doing great. I mean, they had very low unemployment, very high growth. Now there's been a reversal. So that kind of gives us an idea, as a proxy as to what's been happening in downstate Illinois.
How is the Illinois Farm Bureau reacting?
You know, there's general concern there. What can we do as a farm association to try to not just cut supplies, but what we can do to boost demand? And so in the opening general session with our president, he asked everybody in the room, there's, I estimate, between 1,300 to 1,400 people in the opening session there, sitting there, pull out their cell phones and text to a number their support for NAFTA. And then they had up on the screen all those text messages coming in according to where those phones are located in the state of Illinois, and the whole map of Illinois lit up. So that was kind of a dramatic moment up here in Chicago to show that the level of support amongst the farm community and all these family-owned farm businesses for the U.S. to stay in the trade agreements that we have.
Illinois Farm Bureau Chief Economist Mike Doherty spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. The Illinois agricultural economy is more than $121 billion. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast with individual stories and interviews today from Charlie Schlenker, Ryan Denham, and thanks to Mayor Chris Koos for stopping by. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.